myself. Suddenly I'm up on top of the world. Should have been somebody else. Believe it or not, I'm walking on air. I never thought I could feel so free. Flying away on a wing and a prayer. Who could it be? Believe it or not, it's just me.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Hey Kids Comics. I'm your host, Andrew Farmer. Join me, historian, all-around aficionado, producer, hetero life mate, and amazing young man, supple and wow. Spry. Supple and spry, the Jedi Cole Houston.
Oh, yeah. Hello there.
Supple and welcome. Spry. Supple and spry like our topic tonight.
Yes, indeed.
So, yeah, we are on issue 157, I believe, and we are hip deep in the middle of a story arc. I will allow Cole to explain it. It's his story arc, ultimately. So he has fanciful titles and Narnia-esque like places that we're going to go.
Indeed. Yes, this is, in fact, chapter 2 of Toylandia.
It is.
Where we are exploring one of our favorite recurring topics, and that is, of course, comic books as toys, toys as comic books, comic toys as books,
bookity comic toys.
As toys. Call it what you will. The comic book and the toy have, toys have certainly been around a lot longer. Turns out that Stone Venus was just an action figure.
It's the name of my next album, too. Stone Venus. Believe it or not, I'm walking on air. That's my first single.
Cover that.
I'm covering The Greatest American Hero. This episode, this issue of Hey Kids Comics will be Greatest American Hero heavy. I'm just warning you now.
Yeah, just be prepared. So, from that, we go on to let you know that this is the second chapter, Mego, depending on your region and your favored pronunciation.
Right, it's like Crick or Creek.
Wow, it's like Rooster Cogburn, where he told the guys to throw their guns in the Crick.
You know who I miss?
And it turned out his rifle wasn't loaded, so it was the Crick trick.
Do you know who I miss greatly?
Who do you miss?
Robert Culp. Do you know who Robert Culp is? I bet you do know who Robert Culp is. Well,
the memory remains, but the pain never goes
away. It's Robert Culp, character actor extraordinaire, played Bill Maxwell on Greatest American Hero. Believe it or not, I'm walking on air.
You were warned.
You were warned. You were
indeed,
warned.
Indeed, you were warned.
Okay, I'm so, done. I'm done for the next 15 minutes.
Needless to say, one of the things I think most of us think about
punchy
when you are when the name of Mego or Mego comes up is their vast superhero lines,
right? The huge, just everything you'd ever want.
Yeah, there's just a tonnage or a tonnage, if you will.
It's, yeah, if you're Connie Cecilia.
And as we talked about in the last episode, yeah, we mentioned, of course, that they had, in many ways, they were sort of like the Funko of their day.
Right.
Because they bought up a lot of licensing.
Well, you know what's really... Okay, so if we're going to talk about Mego, they started in a way that no toy company could possibly start now. Possibly start now. And the way that they started was with a... original character in the form of Action Jackson.
Oh, yes, that's
no,
true.
Can you imagine a toy company now becoming a successful toy line? We talk about Funko. Funko did not become successful on the back of an original idea.
Yeah, they didn't come out with, like,
what's the last original toy you can think of? Like real, honest to God, like action figure that took off that was based on nothing but an idea and a toy that was released.
Yes, that's a good question. I think in a sense you could point to action figure lines that weren't based on a pre-existing property.
Right.
that became their own property in a sense, but the last original would have to be somewhere, I would say the Transformers.
Probably.
Because they took bits and pieces from a dozen different toy lines in Japan.
Right.
Rebranded and renamed them and built a mythos around something that, but even that technically doesn't fall into the original because they just took something that already existed and rebranded it.
So I think that's why, and not to get too heady, but I think that that's why our generation identifies with toys. You know, like the generation that's coming in now, I would say I'm probably about the youngest, you know, of this generation that really identifies with toy collecting. And by that I mean like Hot Toys. And Hot Toys obviously sells a lot to a lot of different people, but I think that there's a certain demographic, and it's not just people with money. It's people that hold a certain nostalgia for what toys were, because what we used to do was go to the store and buy toys. We didn't buy licensed memorabilia. We bought toys. The licensed memorabilia kind of movement really started, I think really started with Star Wars. I think that, and not that either of us would ever bitch about that ever, but I think that really got its start. All of a sudden people were like, oh shit, this works. We should all jump on it.
And I actually have to amend my previous statement.
Okay.
As my mind got working, there was one original toy line that began in the 80s.
Okay.
Perpetuates to this day with popularity beyond imagination.
All right.
That was, to my knowledge, the last to start out solely as a toy line.
Okay.
Not as a crossover with a show development behind it. And that was the Masters of the Universe line.
That is very true.
That was an original series, and it was some time before someone said, hey... It literally came in right on the cusp of everything becoming a cartoon.
No, you're right.
Which is the era that gave us like a Pac-Man cartoon and other
unlikely
scenarios.
Chuck Norris Karate Commandos cartoons.
Yes, exactly. And so, really, I remember my younger brother buying a few He-Man or Masters of the Universe figures back when they were brand new.
Oh, I had a shit ton. I had all of them.
Previously unheard of. And there was no television support or movie support or anything. Mattel created, for the last time perhaps, an original toy line with the full recognition that things like Star Wars sold because there were so many characters
right
to choose from. You could, and they probably recognized the fact that, by and large, not every kid buying Star Wars toys necessarily always played Star Wars.
Right.
They often would become the vehicle for something else. They were just the analog, the representation of original characters. So, yes, for the very last time, and in fact, it's funny you bring that up because I remember, I don't know if it was like an episode of The Apprentice or one of those type of something similar, where they were, had a group, two groups charged with like creating a toy, and they actually, you know, did like a little focus group with a bunch of kids, let them play with them and see what they thought. And this, I bring this up because what you say really underscores this, because one group, this one guy was spearheading this idea of, like, you know, having an original action figure line with original characters.
Right.
And the other group just made a radio-controlled truck.
Right.
And it was that group that succeeded.
The radio-controlled truck? Yeah.
Yeah. I'm like, you know... To me, that's a smack of the Simpsons, you know, why don't you take an existing product and put a clock in it?
Right. No, but that's why we gravitate towards these toys. That's why we gravitate towards, you know, that's why it's not so weird anymore for someone to, you know, it used to be like, oh, if you were a grown man and you had toys, you would go, you know, well, I'm buying those for my kid, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, you have some children? No.
Kidding. But now... It's not unheard of, you know. It's not weird. eBay exists for a reason. We go back and we find we delve into our own nostalgia, which is one of the reasons that Mego is still popular. Is we delve into our nostalgia, because these toys, stuff like Action Jackson existed, where there was no, we had toys to play with toys. We didn't have licensed material to recreate something. We had imagination. And I don't want to get on my soapbox. You know, you damn whippersnappers and your Yanni and your
Hula
Hoops.
You don't come off like me now.
I know. I'm getting there. I'm getting there, Cole. I'm crossing a certain border. But yeah, it was made, the Action Jackson line was made to compete with G.I. Joe, which had their own 8-inch figures at the time. But it became
Mattel
really...
back in the day, and like back in the 60s, had a line called Major Matt Mason.
Didn't he have a beard?
I don't think so.
You know, that's why you don't remember.
He worked at Disney or something. You couldn't wear a beard.
That's why you don't remember, because he didn't have a beard. I'm telling
you.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah.
But the Major Matt and Mason
Roadblock
line,
had a beard.
Were kind of like rubber figures with a wire armature.
Okay.
And they were just mainly a bunch of interchangeable spacemen.
Okay.
They all effectively had the same body, different heads, and different paint schemes. But he had, like, you know, a little cool hover cycle, like Night Owl.
Okay.
He had some, you know, there were various play sets and an alien and stuff. And I remember, I never had any of them myself, but I had a friend who did, and they were just incredibly cool. And so the action figure existed in fits and starts. But in many ways, Mego was a pioneer in exactly the same way Kenner would become a pioneer in the 3¾-inch line.
Right. Right. I mean, because the thing that Mego did, and we'll get into this, is put out affordable quality action figures and play sets and vehicles that you could actually afford to own.
Yes. And what it also did was... it took the concept of G.I. Joe, which essentially, not to put too fine a point on it, was a doll for boys.
Mm-hmm.
Because it had all of the... It was the, you know... I remember as a kid being fascinated by all the crap that Barbie had.
Right.
You know, she had no end of cool crap going on. And like, hey, you know, how about a little something for the guys?
Mm-hmm.
We don't have to be embarrassed by thinking that's pretty cool. And what they did with the G.I. Joe line essentially was give you that same sort of idea where you had different costumes.
Right.
And clothing and tons of accessories. So.
And what they did with Action Jackson was they realized that while G.I. Joe was kind of steeped in reality, they
at
kind
least
of
back then,
yeah, yeah, not Ice Cream
I think
Soldier,
clearly,
but
like, they began taking cues back and forth like some sort of bizarre ping pong match.
And but they kind of took it outside of the realm of just took it outside of the realm of just, you know, real world standards and made it a little crazier, which was awesome because, you know, it's the 70s and that's what we needed. So there you go.
Yeah, because it was also about that time that G.I. Joe literally got demilitarized.
Right, right.
And became the Action Team.
Action Team. Action Team 5 News. Believe it or not, Action Team 5 is news is in the air. Yeah, see?
Oh, there you go.
It's going to happen this entire show.
That's right.
I'm going to keep coming with it. Just it's going to happen. Just expect it. It's never. I'm going to bring it like Michael Pear. Yeah. Like Tony Vasiliani in Greatest American Hero. That's
In fact, the only other toy line I can think of that period is Mark's Toys, who apparently didn't know how to do anything but hard plastics, had a Western line. It was Johnny West, if I'm not mistaken. And what was cool about those figures is they came with a veritable ton of accessories. If you bought, like, a Johnny West cowboy, he would have a hat, a holster, a, you know, couple of... six shooters, a rifle, a mess kit, a skillet, a Bowie knife with a sheath.
With a sheath.
And, you know, it's everything he needed, like a bedroll.
It's just a horse, an actual living horse.
And so I think, you know, in many ways, this was a point where the action figure was coming of its own. And Mego certainly recognized that. And we were beginning to move away from, like, little toy soldiers into big toy soldiers.
And from there, because that, the Action Jackson line ran from 71 to 74. And at some point in 71, somebody went, wait a second. maybe this whole licensed idea ain't so bad. Let's go, you know, let's get ballsy with this. You know, we could just go to Marvel and hook up with them and make Avengers action figures. Or we could just go to DC and make Justice League action figures. Or we just go to both. Why not? We'll just make up a line.
Yeah, that's something that was never going to happen again.
No, no.
Because at that point, the rivalry was not so tremendously pronounced.
Right.
That such a thing would not even be an option. And what made it work is a concerted decision to simply call the line like Greatest Superheroes or something like that. It didn't tie itself to either license, which then allowed them to fold in a minimal number of outside characters.
Right.
Like Isis, who at the time was not part of the DC fold. And Robert E. Howard's Conan the Barbarian, who they may have been able to finagle in on the Marvel license, I'm not sure.
Maybe.
Because they did use the kind of Joe Kubert-y looking
art.
You know, watch somebody say, well, you know, Joe Kubert never drew Conan.
Yeah, no, Joe Kubert never drew.
I have no idea. Just kind of had a Kubert-y feel.
That's right. But they, the cool thing was, because of, and Cole will speak to this, but because of the way that they made the figures, they really could just basically go all in and make any figure. And we didn't need the super articulation, and great molds are awesome. You've heard us talk about them at length. Like, oh, they changed the head on the one beast to the other beast. Or, and we love it. It's friggin' great. But for what these toys were, you slapped a cloth costume on them, and you didn't have to worry about it. You were good. You didn't have to. That was fine with us. Like, at that age, for those kids, like, we were flying high on that, and nobody needed to worry about it.
Absolutely. Well, the neat thing was also the unprecedented decision to pursue both lines, both licenses, and just call it Official World's Greatest Superheroes.
Right.
And, you know, you got the Fantastic Four back when we weren't terrified for the Human Torch to be portrayed outside of the comics.
Right.
You got a great number of the Avengers. I'm sure that, you know, had the line lasted longer, they may well have considered others. But the neat thing is they went in with mostly heroes, but they brought you a lot of villains.
Yeah.
Mostly Spider-Man villains. They seem to be the most compelling.
Yeah, you got your Batman mix in there too, though.
I guess on the Marvel side, mostly Spider-Man.
Yes.
And as we talked about before on the Superman issue, the strength of the Mego figure was that they just reused the same body for most everybody.
Right.
It didn't matter who you were. Everybody got the same body, the same hands. You could just change the color of the plastic going into the mold.
Right.
You know, and they really, you basically, there's a, I think in the term in animation is like a running change. That's where you have like a character who maybe if Homer is going to wear a Mardi Gras outfit or something for an episode.
Yeah.
You might have a running change that is basically the where normally, you know, to keep things simple for the animators, everything's the same. So there were actually only a few running changes ever done in the Mego line.
Okay.
That is to say, everybody had the same body, from Mr. Fantastic to Conan, Aquaman to Captain America, and all they made one female body. Invisible Woman got it, Wonder Woman got it.
Right.
End of story. They actually had two specialized male bodies that only got used two different times each.
Okay.
That would be the Hulk body,
mm-hmm.
which was shared with the Thing. And in an interesting bit of probably very carefully calculated materials, use of materials and what's the word I'm looking for here? But, you know, to keep the execution just as precise as possible, Hulk and Thing are a little shorter than everybody else.
Oh, to keep the plastic, the...
Yeah, I think they're both by volume using the same...
So the cost-benefit analysis, like the...
Yeah, somebody worked out the engineered, or, worked out the specifics of how much plastic was going to get shot into a mold if you made the Thing versus, say, making Tarzan. Which
okay.
is another interesting choice outside the common comics. But oddly enough, having Tarzan and Conan in the mix recognized that Marvel and DC were both publishing those characters.
Right.
The other running change body that only got used twice was the Penguin slash Mr.
Oh, the little fatter. The little more robust.
The chubby guy.
Okay.
The fat suit, basically.
Right.
And therein, you had... Your costs were remarkably cheap because you could run, you know... A batch of Invisible Woman one day, a batch of Wonder Woman the next, and a batch of Uhura for the Star Trek line.
Right.
As for the male body, it could be General Ursus from the Planet of the Apes, or it could be Captain America or Batman.
I think Captain America, definitely, bar none. Was the greatest. Believe it or not, I'm walking on air. I was waiting for you to mention Captain America. I'm sitting here just waiting. You're right. Like, it was a brilliant tactical business move. Like, we always talk about these things as if they're kind of made alchemically out of dirt and then given to us. Like, there's no material cost behind any of it. You know, like when we talk about, we've had comic book conversations about Mondo paper and, you know, all those things and the cost, but, you know, guys, toys cost money. Like, they cost money to make, they need to make money to make more.
And so, also, an interesting thing about the cost analysis is, what's brilliant here is the biggest expense in the past. I think we're going to see that less and less so. I think that's where you're seeing so much now. Because the biggest expense in toy manufacture was tooling up. The mold cost a fortune.
Right.
Your action figures probably cost pennies on the dollar to manufacture. But you had to make up hundreds of thousands of dollars in tooling.
Right. Because nothing was done. Everything was done by hand.
Yeah.
You didn't have CAD machines carving these things out of aluminum, you know, of aluminum blocks.
Yeah, because in this day and age, we are this side of willing anything we want into existence.
Let's not talk about the technological paradox when toys start making toys, because that's when it's all over. That's Skynet.
That's when we need to start bombing the island of misfit toys.
That's when
I mean, it's an island. Where are they going to go?
When, what's the name of the elf that wanted to be the dentist? When he starts making more elves that want to be dentists, we're doomed.
When there are more dentists on every street corner than bail bondsmen near the local police precinct,
we're doomed.
Elf Dennis, I should say. I'm nothing against regular Dennis.
Yeah, Elf Dennis. We're, do not unionize Elf Dentists. Whatever you do, they're just making themselves. They're just self-replicating Elf Dentists.
That's... This were some interesting, you know, value-added type of things.
Are we still talking about Elf Dentists?
No.
God damn it.
I'm trying to get us back on track. No. Because you had... depending on the character, very often you could get away with using the same boots.
Yes. Oh, the boots. Here we go.
Everybody. The same big oven mitt gloves.
Vacuum molded boots.
Yeah, oh, yes. Yeah. So this wonderful little hollow plastic boots. You had the giant oven mitt gloves that would later be... just using the regular people hands and whatever color their gloves might be became the favorite way to go.
So why did they make like these you know, space age polymer, you know, vacuum mold, hermetically sealed boots? Because anybody who's ever had a Mego or Mego or however you want to pronounce it and has decided to try, like you said last episode, like you said last issue, tried to take a gut, it's going to take a miracle. Enough, you know, grease to get your head out from between the stair rails, and you know, and some sort of Ray Palmer-esque quantum, you know, linear string theory physics to get that boot back on there. But yet,
yeah,
on the hand,
not only will you never get the boot back on as easily as you took it off,
right?
You will never get the boot back on relative to the factory pants.
Ah, yes.
Because all that cloth, I don't know how they do that at the factory. Is it under some sort of extreme temperatures that
it's got to be, right?
Can't be replicated at home. There has to be some sort of magic there that we're not aware of.
Orcs made it under the Eye of Sauron. That's
because like once it hits the air, it then seals down for good.
Yeah, it's done. It's done.
And you know,
I wonder if they were heat molded. Like, you know how you can get the wire, you know, like the wire sealing that you put on, then you heat it up and it vacuums to the.
Yeah, I don't. It's bizarre, but you will never be able to get that cloth as pristine as it looked coming out of the factory. So, you know, careful with your Migos. Don't get curious about, you know,
what's under the boot.
Don't recreate Abbey Road with your figures. If you do, use Hulk. He's already barefoot. See, the thing is, the Hulk was a godsend because, you know, they had to tool up with that different body that they went and covered up with a cloth outfit for the thing.
Yeah.
But with him, all they had to do was some factory torn up pants.
It was the defective pants.
Yeah.
From all the other ones. They were happy. The Hulk was their throwaway.
Like, anybody screwed up the pants, they just bleach them and dye them purple.
The Hulk is how they went to jail. Which we'll talk about later, but yeah, the Hulk is how they went to jail.
But you know, like with Superman, Batman, any number of characters that have... There were several characters that had a kind of value added to them.
Okay.
Because, like Superman, Batman, you have the cloth costume, but you have the additional material for the cape. You have the Green Goblin, because you had to make special pointy boots for him.
Right.
He can't just have the average boot. Plus, he has to have his man purse.
Can you imagine? And you went, you did it. Like, I was a little past that point, right? But I imagine the difference between kids. If we could take kids today, that are, let's say the ones that were at what was the Star Wars release night for the new toys, right?
Oh, Force Friday. Yes.
Let's say 16-year-old kids. Let's say 16-year-olds. They were out for Force Friday buying toys. And transport them back in time to 1976. And put them in front of a display with these toys. They would probably burst into flame immediately.
Yeah, you know, you stick them in front of these toys at a Gibson's.
Right, at a Gold Circle.
Aughts 5 and 10.
Gold Circle. My favorite place as a kid to go buy toys, Gold Circle. But one thing, and I think the most important thing, and they probably weren't the first to do a lot of things. you know, I imagine that somebody was out there doing it, but I think they were probably the first to do it on a mass scale, was they were the first to do a great many things in the toy industry. They were innovators. Not only did they have the comic book license on point, you know, not only did they have that down, but we were talking earlier that one of the things that they did first was they were the first that I know of to do variant action figures.
That's true. They did have some, speaking of, running changes.
Right. They had a special agreement with Montgomery Ward. And through Montgomery Ward stores, they sold Batman, Superman, and Spider-Man Secret Identity figures, where it was Clark Kent, Bruce Wayne, and Peter Parker. And as far as I know, that was the first time that there was really, in a big way, a variant released action figure.
Well, that and the kind of store exclusivity.
Exactly. Yes. No, you're absolutely right. That was the San Diego Comic-Con exclusive of their time.
Or, like, for example, you know, you invoked the Star Wars The Force Friday stuff. Right now, Toys R Us and Target and even Kmart.
Ah, the dreaded Kmart.
Yeah, are having exclusives in the Star Wars line. And, you know, we decry as collectors these exclusives, but apparently that's been going on for a long-ass time.
Right. They also, because the precursor to Kmart, your dreaded Kmart, their store lineup, the way that they set up their stores, was they didn't have any shelves. They had pegboards. So they could not display effectively Mego dolls. Explain the packaging.
And that was interesting because I do remember both my childhood. I never really had very many of them. I did have Aquaman, of course.
Well, sure.
You know, you kind of had to if you were me.
If you were Cole, you had to have him.
Because how cool was that? And I really wanted the lizard because talk about value added.
He had a lizard head.
Ab coat, shirt, pants, and a cloth, stuffed cloth tail.
Lizard head, dude.
And a lizard head.
Lizard head.
And interestingly enough, a lizard head that he shared with Mego's Gorn.
Well, I mean, they were smart. What can you say?
Yeah.
They knew what they were doing.
And to avoid confusion, it had never occurred to me until this point. To avoid confusion, that must be why the Gorn was brown.
Okay.
Because they probably didn't feel like they could make it green, and then, you know, maybe your grandma would go, oh, here's that lizard he's been wanting. Here's that Star Trek figure he wanted that said looks like a lizard. Oh, no.
Oh, it's Grandma.
Yeah, Grandma, I love you, but...
But the nice thing about having a Gorn Mego and having a Kirk Mego was that all the components you need to reenact their fateful gladiatorial battle are just in your backyard.
That was so true, especially because in my backyard, oddly enough, we had deposits of diamonds, sulfur, and charcoal, as well as small broken up bamboo shoots.
I was going to say giant tubular.
Some bamboo growing out there.
Nice.
Now, we often would mix our own gunpowder and
we often would mix our
fire
own
fusillades of diamonds.
Of razor sharp diamonds into each other.
In all fairness, it was just quartz. But,
I mean, come on. It was don't sell out the cubic zirconia.
It was for pretend.
It was for pretend. We pretended it was diamonds.
That's right. But the thing about it was in the superhero realm, the original Mego figures came in window boxes.
Well, before that, they didn't. They just came in boxes.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, they were more like the original G.I. Joe, which came in like a little narrow shoebox almost.
Do you know why they changed it?
Why did they change it?
Because
it's out in our research.
Because of assholes like us, Cole, that weren't satisfied with what the box said wanted to put our own eyes on it. That's why.
It's like that line in the Les Miserables, the customer sees what the customer gets.
That's right.
Wow. Paraphrase a little bit, you know, it's like, it's the same for the toy as it is for the grocer.
Thank you for classing up the joint tonight. You know, it reminds me.
It would have been so easy to go, to actually sing the line and not paraphrase it.
You know, it reminds me of that line from Les Mis when they were, you know, getting ready, they were getting ready to fight, and they were, you know, they were singing, Let Them Run Amok. You know, that part, which I know all of Les Mis because I've been in it like 5 times, but my favorite part was when they went, believe it or not, I'm walking on air. That was my favorite part. It was Jean Valjean that really was...
Yeah, belting that one out.
Just launching into that one. All right, go on. I'm running out of steam on the Greatest American Hero thing, I think.
But you were mentioning that. Okay, the progression was that, yes, people wanted to actually have an idea what was in that box. Like,
right.
The art looks great. But then you open it up and you see the thing's just wearing pajamas. You know, he's like got the thing head and thing hands, and he's wearing his thing underoos and footsies.
Thing yamas, yeah.
Yeah, it's just not the same. Ooh. So, you know, there was certainly a demand for...
So they went to window boxes.
Yes.
And then the precursor to Kmart, which we can only, I think we settled on, how are we pronouncing this? SS?
Oh, yes.
Kreskies? SS Kreskies?
Yeah, I think it was like Kresky.
SS Kresky, which would become the dreaded bane of Cole's existence, Kmart, reached out and was like, guys, I appreciate the boxes and all, but all we got is pegboards up in here. Can you do something? So they created the what is now referred to as the Kresge style card, which is the what we now call the blister card. So
yeah, and what I love about the initial Mego blister card is they would tend to release their figures as a lineup,
right?
And you would have 6 characters in a lineup. And it was almost like old pre-code EC horror comic covers, but instead of like the old hag and the morgue operator or what have you, we just have these little circular icons of all the characters.
Right.
Reusing existing artwork that DC wasn't going to
ever
miss
use.
Out on the chance to make some more money on.
Right. The Wolverine style.
Yeah, the sort of thing that, you know, 30 years later would lead to Image Comics, or 20-something years later.
So we have them to blame for a lot.
Believe it or not!
Ah, yes! Yes! Yeah. Just, it's the good, whenever you run out of steam, I'm telling you.
That's right. It's like a shot in the arm.
You just go right to it. Just jump right in. Don't have, everyone out there, I challenge you over the weekend. If you ever are just, you're feeling down, you're feeling, you know, I want you to actualize the Greatest American Hero.
Don't reach for a 5-hour energy. Don't go down to the PX or the bodega or whatever and get a Red Bull or something like that. You know what gives you wings?
Believe it or not! Greatest American Hero gives you wings. It certainly does. There's no... It is my battle hymn of the Republic, is what it is.
So the interesting thing, though, also with the Mego figures is, like, the choices made. For a boys' line, it was rather curious. Speaking of things that would never happen again, for one thing, they had tremendous respect for the idea that boys would still want the female characters.
Yeah.
Yet at the same time, they felt, I think, the common fallacy is you have to girl things up. Episode 1 with Star Wars, Hasbro felt like they had to girl things up and did a disastrous line of girly Queen Amidala characters.
Oh, yeah, they did.
And, frankly, girls didn't want them.
Right.
And nobody wanted them because they were kind of crappy, but there you have it. But, yes, you did see that sort of progression from that was answering market pressure. And Mego did very well for itself, I think, until such time as plastic becomes king.
Right. No, absolutely they did. I think we would be remiss, as we're kind of working ourselves into the third act here, if we didn't talk a little bit about, and I know this is a favorite subject of yours, if we didn't talk a little bit about the Micronauts.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Because the
Go ahead. Oh, yeah. No, they were very much, you know, I'd invoked the Transformers previously. Micronauts was the same thing, where a toy company goes to Japan and sees what's coming out in Japan is Dachatopikato. And
casual racism, ladies and gentlemen. just off the top.
Dachatopikato is my go-to
Japanese toy company.
Yeah, well, the toy line, or anything Japanese, be it an anime or a toy line, or anything that I'm not personally familiar with.
Just if you've ever been to a really good coffee shop and they make a latte and there's that foam at the top and then they take the knife, or a bar where they're cutting the head off of a beer and they just take it right, that part that they cut off is the level of Cole's casual racism towards Japanese toys.
Sort of like frothy.
You didn't want it anyway.
It's a frothy excess.
You didn't want it anyway. You just let it run down the side of the glass. You didn't want it anyway. Just forget it ever happens.
But yeah, I don't recall what the actual name of the...
Give me the name one more time. I just want to hear it one more time.
Damn it. It was, of course, the ever-popular Dachatopikato.
I like the fact that it changes every time, too.
Just subtly.
It's an accent. Oh, it's so good. I missed it. I missed our toy talks, Cole. Inevitably, we fall on, and I'm sure we will again, and I'll do it, too. I'm not over here acting like a saint, and I'm the one that I think started it with, Kamakata Kobate, whatever that was. I need 87 points of articulation on this 6-inch Batman doll.
That's right. I want every fingernail to be articulated.
I want him to be able to lose fingernails and regrow fingernails.
Oh, my
God. Coming back around now, Micronauts was a toy line 76 that came out of Mego. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't Micronauts one of those instances where the toys became a comic book?
Yes, indeed.
Okay, so that's
they
important.
They start out as the unnamed Japanese toy line. Shame sets in.
Don't let the shame hit you. I guarantee you we're not offending
anyone. Believe it or not!
Yes!
So, you have the... that gets imported to America as the Micronauts. And one of the really cool, innovative things about that line is two things happen. You have this really cool idea of interchangeable parts that was uniquely Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, all of your toys could be combined with all of your other toys into strange new combinations. And the other interesting thing, rather curious thing that happens, is Mego created some curious vans. Because there was a time when the automobile style known as the van was a very popular.
Oh, very much so, yes.
That was one of the many things a van was a cool thing. So Batman and Joker had rival... souped up vans, like right out of Cartoons magazine,
like conversion vans, like real deal porthole windowed.
Yeah, the only thing that was missing was the teardrop shaped portal window. But the nice thing about buying up somebody else's pre-existing tooling and subverting it to your purposes is you don't have to tool up for, like, a Batcopter.
Right.
Or some weird two-seated, curious Bat-Horley gig thing that just nobody can quite fathom what it's meant to be. Or a vinyl cardboard sheathed and vinyl play sets and things like that.
Right.
there were, I believe it might have been the, there was a Micronauts toy, essentially, is what I'm getting at, that got repurposed as a ground vehicle.
Okay.
For their greatest superheroes line.
Right.
And it basically was a Micronauts vehicle that looked kind of like a giant Super Judge Dredd tricycle with a Green Arrow sensibility kind of rubber tipped projectile.
Nice.
On the front.
Nice. But do you know what? So Mego wasn't always, they didn't make the best decisions. Let's just say that. They made really good decisions. They made innovative decisions. But do you know what they passed on to take Micronauts?
What was that?
Star Wars. They didn't want to make a toy line based on a B sci-fi movie when they could go to Japan and buy Micronauts.
Yeah.
So they passed on Star Wars. Kenner picked it up, and the past is prologue at this point. I think we all know how that worked out.
You know, at the same period where Kenner was raking in the dough with Star Wars figures, Mego was fielding Love Boat.
Right, they were on their way out at that point. Their time had passed, essentially, and what they did was, and I think this is a good place to kind of wrap it up, because this is the rise and fall. You know, we're getting towards the end. This is the rise and fall of Mego. Mego landed on moving into electronic toys, kind of in the late to early 80s, with the 2XL toy robot.
Ah, yes.
Which, if you haven't seen the 2XL toy robot, and keep in mind, this is the period where, you know, Rocky II had, you know, whatever the weird Herbie beer bot was that they rolled out. But they did have the 2XL.
Rudimentary robotics was a cool thing.
Right. They picked it up from a bunch of different, like, it was passed on by a bunch of different toy companies. Essentially, it used an 8-track tape to run. That's pretty amazing in and of itself. But that's pretty rad. Like they tried to break into the world of like electronics, and it just wasn't taking. But you know, they gave it a shot.
That was also the period that brought us things like ROM the Space Knight.
Right.
Early attempts at trying to make something happen.
And they were trying, I mean, at the time, if you look at what they were putting out, you know, this is when they went full on license and were doing like Happy Days, Laverne and Shirley, Starsky and Hutch, Wizard of Oz, and they were in their heyday, they were in their prime. Like I was talking to Cole before, if you do the research, they were putting on, they were doing giant events, like at the Waldorf Astoria with Sonny and Cher to release the Sonny and Cher dolls. They were having giant Wizard of Oz parties when they released the Wizard of Oz dolls, where they had all the surviving members of the main cast of the Wizard of Oz there. So they were really, really living the high life, like in the mid to late 70s. But then I honestly believe they, I think that the decision, I think somebody somewhere would tell you if there was a documentary on this, that the fall of Mego starts when they pass on Star Wars.
Yeah.
I think it does.
I think, yeah, it was a regretful thing for a lot of companies, but that would have been, I think, for them, the best possible scenario.
Right.
And this is a period, you know, where companies like that were really struggling to find a market.
And could you have imagined how, if they would have taken the Star Wars license and Kenner wouldn't have, can you imagine how it would have changed toys? That if you could go to that point in history and watch the break, you know, like
yes,
the anomaly where they end up getting the license. What would we be looking at as toys today? Because everything that we buy as toy collectors has spun out of the fact that the Star Wars line was so popular with the 3 3/4 inch figures. So from then on, you know, we got everything past that point was, you know, 3 3/4 inch G.I. Joes going 3 3/4 inch comic book, you know, the Secret Wars figures through, you know, through the bigger 6-inch figures based on the 3 3, essentially based on 3 3/4 inch figures. If it would have stayed Mego, would we be looking at, you know, plastic and cloth figures to this day instead of kind of in the niche where they are now? It's a really interesting thing.
And you do have to ask yourself, would Star Wars as a toy line have survived?
That's a good point.
Under Mego? Would they have had the foresight that, you know, a Kenner, a head of Kenner, and was willing to, you know, recognize that the strength of this line wasn't going to be from what they had to go on. If they were going to go in all in on this movie,
right,
the strength of this line was not going to be in the characters as much as the vehicles. And they recognized, you know, Mego went downscaled from the 12-inch scale that was most common for, you know, like G.I. Joe was a 12-inch tall figure,
right,
so the costs were considerably more. You know, even the, and Matt Mason's stuff was smaller.
Right.
But different. So, you know, scaling down to an 8-inch scale made sense, but it also meant it limited you severely on something that someone recognized was a very vehicular heavy.
Right.
You know, there were going to be a lot of really cool, you wouldn't be able to do them, you know, proper to 100% to scale with the figures, but you could do an approximation thereof.
Right.
That would be absolutely, that's what was going to sell this line. And would someone at Mego have made the same decision? And that's impossible. We'll never know, but it's unlikely.
Right.
In fact, when Mego began to scale toward that end, it was more reactionary than,
of course,
than being pioneer.
Right. And then Mego essentially falls apart. The two executives get brought in on charges of wire fraud, tax evasion, and defrauding. It was the 80s. It reads, if you get the chance to do it, the affidavit is out there. It's 717F2D9 United States versus S. Siegel B. Basically, they get brought in on charges of wire fraud, tax evasion, and defrauding to the tune of $100,000, which in 1982 for a toy company was a lot of money.
That was some good cash.
Yeah, so granted, it is the 80s, but they were hurting, and luckily for us, we've seen a resurgence since about the mid-90s, up to about 2002 when it really hit its stride, and then 2009 when Mego started getting made again in a big way. And now you can go out to your local Toys R Us, you can go to your local comic shop, and you can get Mego toys, which is really cool, and it's a blessing to us of the little bit older crowd, and to the little bit younger crowd too, to see kind of the roots of where things came from, and they're still doing them essentially the same way, so good on them for that.
Yeah, and that's neat that format is one that's being revitalized in a great sense. I did find out that the one of the Micronauts toys, the Solarian,
okay,
became the Spider-Mobile.
Oh, did it?
For the Mego line.
Nice. And as we're coming to a close, if you are interested in Mego, first of all, you are probably really bored because you probably know more about it than we do. Second of all, if you are, you know, interested and you don't know more about it and you are in the Midwest, you can go to something known as Mego Meet. And you know we love our conventions here at Hey Kids Comics in the Jedi Cole universe. Mego has its own convention called Mego Meet. Apparently it moved to Skokie, Illinois. All Mego, all the time, for 3 days, or 2 days plus a night with no real constructed content. But it looks really cool, and I would, and I think Cole hit it the nail on the head. What did you say earlier about what we should do when we go to Mego Meet?
Oh yes, we should go and to one of the panels if they bring in some, you know, former executive or officer, someone who worked on the various toy lines, and just, you know, incessantly bring up the indictment.
Excuse me, sir.
Yeah. Why precisely are you not talking
about? What do you have to hide? Like, that was 20 years ago. You can't bury the truth.
That's right. We're Mego truthers.
We're Mego truthers. Hashtag Mego truthers. Brilliant. Brilliant. And on that note, Cole, why don't you start wrapping us up?
Yes, I fear someone's going to take us up on this whole Mego Meet thing next year.
I hope I'm in the Midwest. I could very well get there in about 6 hours. I could get to Skokie, sure, Illinois in about 6 hours and go to Mego Meet just to do it. So if anybody would like to join me in 2016 for Mego Meet, let me know. I'll go. I'll go in a heartbeat. I don't care. I went to the G.I. Joe thing by myself for the first time last year. Luckily, Eddie Medina was there to save my bacon. But go. I'll go to any convention, anytime, anywhere. I don't care. Let's go to Mego Meet. Real talk.
Absolutely. And I don't know, in closing, if this is real.
Oh, God.
If this is the real or not. But I stumbled on, someone had shown on what looks like the mock-up for a big ad for the upcoming Mego Star Trek line for 78.
Okay.
And, you know, it shows that cardboard vinyl Enterprise that had the little, you know, turnaround transporter thing and all that, the bridge.
Right.
That was, would also double as a carrying case. If this is legit, there is some evidence that they intended to have add Chekhov and Sulu to the line.
Okay.
Have Dr. McCoy in his little short-sleeve clinic outfit.
Nice.
Kirk in his dress uniform with that weird sort of little crossover.
Yeah, the double-breasted weird, yeah.
The salt vampire.
No! No!
The Orion slave girl.
Okay.
Trelane.
Trelane?
Con!
Oh, I would love Amigo. I would love Amigo Con.
Oh, but it gets better. A two-pack of Sarek and Amanda.
No. No.
As well, I mean, you can't just have one in the two-pack line. You have Gary Seven with Roberta Lincoln and the cat.
No, come on.
Oh, how we wish that this had happened. They were also planning two packs, apparently, of Kirk and Gorn, Kirk and Spock, Spock and Sarek, McCoy and M113, and Lieutenant Uhura and Marta, it looks like.
Nice.
Tiny, tiny print, but there you have it.
I would first of all, never assault vampire. Get that out of my house. Scariest thing I've ever seen in my life. Gave me nightmares for 3 weeks.
I do want to point out that this does answer very much the question of, had they taken Star Wars, if this was their lineup for 1978.
Right.
Ugh. So with that, we are, of course, bringing you all this toy goodness. And I also want to point out, this is the second of the 5-issue story arc that leads us into Under the Tree. Under the Tree, where we'll talk about our top wish list picks for Christmas 2015. And we're coming to you from the Jedi Cole universe at JediCole.com. Of course, you can look for the occasional tweets on Twitter at the Jedi Cole U. You can write to us at jcumail@yahoo.com. And that's about it there. You can look for myself and Eddie Medina on the Rancor Pit Live from One Eye Joe Studio in Dallas, Texas, on deepelemonair.com. And, of course, look for conventions statewide in Texas on Convention Awareness Project Texas at cap-tx.info.
Yeah, if you can't get to Mego Meet.
That's right. There's still a handful of shows left as we're winding down this year. I'm starting to slowly get the 2016 listings up as well. And there will have been over 100 fan-themed conventions in the state of Texas in 2015. Keep it 100, Texas.
There you go. And the one convention that I want and we haven't had yet, I think Cole and I will both sing it out, would be the Greatest American Hero fan convention. So if you can put that together, anybody that's out there.
Yeah, please, if you can get, like, you know, keynote speaker William Catt.
Please.
You can get the...
Get Michael Pear. I need Mike.
And I think also, like, a little sidebar is, like, bring in a cat rescue.
Right, right. That would be great.
You know, set up there and help.
Somebody that makes special support belts. Belt crafters.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, so Cole, in closing, do you want to sing them out?
Believe it or not, I'm walking on air.
I want to do the Joe Cocker version. You do, yeah. Can you give me a little...